The
this meeting is now being recorded.
Topic for today is really taking a look at outcomes in integrated care. And the reason for the focus on outcomes is because insurers and government agencies are really beginning to look at the outcomes of the care delivered. So they're moving beyond how many X's did you provide, how many Y's did you provide, and they're saying what was the outcome, what were the clinical outcomes. But we can classify outcomes into four different groups, and probably somebody could kind of classify it into more if you wanted, but these four make sense to me. The first are process outcomes, and we'll talk a little bit more about each one of these. Second group are health outcomes themselves, financial outcomes, and then I think the fourth one is one that's more recent in addition, but it's certainly being pressed by CMS and state Medicaid agencies, and that's satisfaction outcomes. And when we talk about satisfaction, we're talking about consumer satisfaction with services. One of the questions is why are we going to bother? You know, why bother to even measure outcomes? Why should we even look at them? Well, one of the goals of healthcare, of course, is to improve healthcare quality. One of the goals of healthcare reform is to improve quality. So one of the ways you know whether or not you're improving quality is to take a look at whether or not, for instance, people are improving their health status as a function of the care that you're providing. So if you're doing addictions treatment, are they more likely to abstain from use of a substance? If you're doing behavioral health counseling, for instance, are they less depressed than they were previously? And if they have a comorbid medical condition, you may be looking at both improvement in other health indicators in addition to simply whether or not depression measurement is better. So you really are going to be looking at a whole host of things. But in the end, what you want to do is you want to improve the quality of the care that you deliver. You also want to get information about what works and what doesn't work. So if you look back at kind of the old addictions treatment, you know, there was a 28-day program, that's what you had to have. And what they found is when they started to look at actual outcomes, that 28 days, there was nothing magical about it. In fact, they could provide addictions treatment in considerably less time just as effectively. So, and that's just one example, but basically looking at health outcomes gives you an opportunity to kind of parse what you're doing and figure out what's the most efficient way to meet the healthcare needs of this particular individual, group of individuals, and get the outcomes that we're looking for. The next thing is to really establish your value as a provider. So have any of you seen a lot of the recent advertising by hospitals where they're really promoting their cancer treatment programs or their cardiovascular programs? Have you all seen those?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what they're trying to do is they're trying to say my outcome really makes me stand apart as a provider of those services and should be a compelling reason for you as a potential consumer of healthcare to select me as a provider. So getting those statistics, for instance, when we treat people who have diabetes, we improve their blood sugar levels by X amount on average. We're talking on average, and people's lifestyle indicators, their activity level improves, their satisfaction with their life improves, gives you a way to sell yourself and really make yourself stand out as a provider. It also makes it more likely to be selected as a preferred provider, for instance, by an accountable care organization, if those are in development in your area, or as a partner with a medical home. And as we talk about integration and we talk about kind of the whole change in the healthcare landscape, one of the really neat opportunities is the ability to partner more with community providers. And if you can, by use of statistics, demonstrate that you have really great outcomes from the services that you provide, then you're going to be more likely to be selected. Okay. It also, you can use it as a way to provide incentives to providers and to establish accountability, both internally as well as organizationally. So, for instance, all things being equal, if you have a couple of practitioners or clinicians and one of them seems to have better health outcomes than the other, one of the things to look at is, you know, why is that? How can you use that that experience to improve your overall clinical quality? So there are lots and lots of reasons. Do any of you have any additional reasons that you might want to consider for why you'd want to measure outcomes? Or do we cover it?
Well, speaking from NIATX's point of view, that's mm-hmm. pretty much what we encourage everybody to do, is to take that one step and measure it somehow so that you can prove either to your funders or to your own executive level, this is why it's important to do what we're doing and what the changes have done in terms of the financial bottom line and quality of care.
That's excellent. And you're absolutely right. It absolutely does fit the whole NIATX model, and it's the foundation of that model. So, yeah, it really feeds right in. So let's look at process outcomes to begin with. These are frequently the starting place for organizations and for individuals as they start to look at outcomes, and in part because they're some of the easier things. Not that they're easy, but some of the easier things to get a hold of. So when we talk about process outcomes, I'll give you one example, and then maybe you know, the group could help generate some additional ones. Time to first appointment, that's a process outcome. Okay, so, or decreasing percentage of no-shows, those are process outcomes. Do you have some others that you could look at in the medical, dental, or behavioral health area, or that you already are looking at? It's a really quiet group. Well, I would bet that you're already looking at some process outcomes. In fact, I think with your current projects, you're definitely looking at them. You're looking at how many referrals did I make? Were they successful, for instance? Those are all process outcomes. And they're really important because they frequently tell you a lot about how your resources are being used, okay, and the efficiency of that resource use, and the ability to meet consumer needs. So process outcomes are critical. If you have, for instance, a process outcome and your time to first appointment is in 4 weeks, you know, basically you could say, I have a bit of a problem with access to services. So I'm going to do some things and improve my process outcome at time to first appointment, and my goal is to get that down to 2 weeks or get it down to a week. And by measuring that information, it gives you a sense of whether or not the steps you're taking are successful and, you know, whether or not you need to make additional adjustments or whether or not you simply are kind of gaining on that. So I do think that, and Jody, I really have to thank you for this, by throwing in dental, I think as we talk about integrated care and outcomes, dental has been the kind of the poor man out, okay? We've talked frequently about medical, behavioral health, addictions. We've oftentimes missed dental, and I really think, particularly with partnerships with FQHCs that offer dental services, starting to look at some outcomes related to dental as well is a good thing to do. There's a lot of data that indicate that dental care has a tremendous impact on overall physical status. So those are kind of process outcomes. Again, they're frequently a starting place, but they're not something you want to give up and just move on to the other things. They are, I think, things that you need to continue to monitor, but probably are going to need to add on to, okay? So then if we look at health outcomes, okay, there are a number of things that you need to take into consideration as you make decisions about what health outcomes you want to pick, all right? First of all, can you collect the information? So, for instance, if you're simply behavioral health and you don't have a lab on site, which would oftentimes be the case, or physicians that order, for instance, a test for blood sugar levels, then you may not want to pick improving blood sugar levels as one of your health outcomes measures because you're not going to be in a very good position to collect those data. Okay. So the first question is, you know, after you make your laundry list, and we'll talk some about what that laundry list should or could contain, you have to first ask yourself, can I even get it? Okay. And then can you use the information? And that has a lot to do with the way in which you maintain your records. If you're on an electronic medical record and the data is a discrete data point and is therefore retrievable versus free text is you can assume it's not retrievable by and large, okay? So if somebody just types in, I did lab on such and such and these were the measurement outcomes, you're probably not going to be able to pull that back out for aggregate reporting, okay? So the first question is, can I even collect it? And then the second is, if I collect it, can I get it back out without undue effort and expense, okay? Then the next question, and I think you really have to talk with your clinical staff about this, is the information useful? Is it useful for care? Is it useful for communication? Is it useful strategically? And when I say strategically, I mean both internally as well as externally. Is it going to help you with some overall strategic goals? Okay. The next question is, does the measure fit the population? Is it meaningful for that subgroup or group of people that you're interested in looking at? And then should you look at some additional risk factors, for instance, illness, diagnosis, medication, age? So if you take a look, again, just shifting back into behavioral health, you could say, well, I want to look at lab values as a function of medications that are prescribed, certain antipsychotics, for instance. So again, if that's an important consideration, which it frequently would be, and you can collect the information, and you're likely to make use of it, then that could be valuable data for you to collect. And then finally, you have to ask, what's the cost to do this? You know, and can I fit it into my budget? If you have, I just think that that's a piece that sometimes people forget about. Because they have really good ideas, and then they simply find out they can't afford to do it. So if we look at what are some common measures for behavioral health, I just want to tell you that it seems to me as I read a lot about outcome stuff that something's happening in the whole integrated care field, and I think of it as sort of settling out. I think there's a settling out of what the measures are, that people are now saying, okay, these are sensible measures for people in integrated care to be looking at. Again, and it doesn't mean looking at for every single person, but in general, you know, these are sensible measures. And I'm going to kind of step back just for a second, kind of a new current that's taking place that says, okay, maybe what we need to do is we need to have a very brief screening instrument that covers a variety of things, that's not too onerous for the clinical staff or the consumer to engage in. And if certain things pop up out of that screening, then we'll look more in depth at some other things, okay? And so, for instance, they might only, instead of looking at the whole PHQ-9, they might do two questions out of that instrument rather than all nine, okay, or four. And there are subsets of the PHQ-9, for instance, that are acceptable for looking at depression. In other words, the instrument's been statistically reviewed in such a way that you could use 2 to 4 questions, specific questions, to give you the starting point for whether or not you needed to continue to screen. So I'm just going to tell you that, and I'll come back to that a little later. But basically, the common measures that seem to be popping up are for depression, using the PHQ-9, as I just said, maybe a PHQ-2 or 4 instead. For addictions risk, the audit seems to be the instrument that's really the most popular. It's very brief. And the CRAFT for children and adolescents. I think CRAFT starts at age 12. For anxiety screening, the GAD seems to be what's in use. The next thing is functional health and well-being, and it's functional health and well-being short form, either the 12 or the 36. I am going to issue a little bit of a caution here because this is a very expensive instrument. When we priced it, we looked at it, we priced it and said, can't afford it. This is one of those things that's really nice, but we really can't afford it. So I do have a couple of other options that I think are much more reasonable from a cost perspective. So, and then for lifestyle and diet, this Glasgow 2005, that's the article that Carol mentioned, that if you look at that, there are some questions that are derived from other instruments that are used to look at activity level, smoking behavior, diet, that help you assess whether or not the person's engaged in a healthy lifestyle. The advantage of using instruments that everybody agrees on is that you can compare data. It's also very objective, and you know somebody else has already done all the statistical analysis, which I really like. If you make up the questions yourself, you can gather a lot of the same kind of information, but it may not be as reliable or valid. So, and it won't necessarily give you the opportunity to compare from one site to another. For tobacco, I have here the Surgeon General questions, but I've also been told about the Fagerstrom scale, which I did go take a look at. It's called the Fagerstrom Tolerance Scale. And I'll put this stuff in an email for everybody because it's not now in the PowerPoint. But it's Fagerstrom Tolerance Scale. And it's a quick way to take a look at tobacco dependence, nicotine dependence. So, again, tobacco being a huge issue from a health perspective. So, but even after you've made some decisions about what instruments you want to build in, there are a whole bunch of additional questions that you have to ask. First, are you going to screen everybody? What we've done, for instance, is we've put together, we're using the PHQ-9, the CAGE, AID, and the GAD. We put them all on, we can put all three instruments on one page, okay? And then we're using the activity information from this Glasgow article, which is actually out of the University of Washington, to assess activity level for our clients. And we do that in an interview format at the medical visits. So, but you do have to make a decision. Are you going to collect or are you going to screen everybody? For children and adolescents, we're only using the CRAFT, okay? And we're only using that from, they said, age 12 up. And that's an addictions instrument. Once you start looking at children and adolescents, you also have to address all of the issues related to parental involvement and consent. And we had to grapple with, gee, if we do this addictions assessment and it turns out that the person's really engaged in some risky alcohol or drug use, what are we going to do? Are we going to tell the parent? How are we going to handle that? And what we said was we're going to tell the adolescent, child or adolescent, that if something comes up that causes us to be concerned about their safety, we are going to inform the parent. We just tell them that up front. So it's possible that some information not disclosed as a result of that, but we just didn't figure we could take those risks. So is anybody using any of these screening instruments currently?
We don't use the, this is Jen from LaCrosse, we don't mm-hmm. use PHQ-9 as we're using the OQ-45.
Oh, okay.
Outpatient clinic, and we love it, and we use it for a variety of reasons, kind of how you were recommending pulling, you know, a different question here or there to focus on the outcomes of. So, similar.
Very, yes, it is similar. And these are not the only instruments. And, you know, and I think that's a very good point. They're not the only ones. There does, as I said, there does seem to be some settling that these are the ones that people seem to be gravitating toward. But there are other options out there that may work better for, you know, different groups. Is anybody else using any?
Oh, this is Andrea from Meta House. We have used the CRAFT in the past. And with our youth population, we just don't have a lot of youth, so it hasn't come up as much, and we aren't currently using it. So our youth program has changed somewhat, but we have used that one in the past.
Okay.
And this is Jody from Northern Health Centers. We are going to begin using the PHQ-9 and the audit and the Fagerstrom as soon as we start our ESPERT services in May, but we haven't
right.
started using them yet.
That's great. One of the things I really encourage people to do is to build in some outcomes, clinical outcomes, as soon as possible, particularly once you start moving into integrated care, because it really does give you a way, it allows you an opportunity to establish a baseline. Where did I start from? And is the care that we're providing making a difference? Is it improving things? And it's really exciting to watch. I don't know how else to say it. It's one of the things that when we get together and look at our particular reverse integration project, once a month we have an administrative meeting, and once a month I get to see all those data, and it's really great to say, oh, you know, 50% of the seriously mentally ill adults who are part of this project are losing weight, okay, which is, I think you all know, is a huge issue for people with who are on psychiatric medications. So get some really fun, I don't know if other people think it was fun, but I think it was fun feedback to the clinical staff that really lets them know we're making a difference. Okay. But you do have to ask, you know, who are we going to collect these on? How often are we going to screen? Because you can drive your consumers kind of batty if you ask them to fill this stuff out every time they walk through the door. So you have to make some decisions about how often do you need to collect these data to really give you good information without it becoming a burden on people. Next thing is, can you get paid to do it? I'm going to tell you in general, not so well. And then what's the operational impact? Who's gonna get the screenings done? How are you gonna get them entered into a system so that you can do some data analysis? Who's gonna do that? Who's gonna do the follow-up if you screen and you do discover that someone's seriously depressed or they have an addiction problem or, you know, or whatever? What are you going to do? How are you going to follow up on that? And who's going to follow up on it? Because you do, sometimes people don't measure these things because they don't have the capacity to act on the information. Okay? So you do want to plan for that, if you can. Okay? Okay, so those are kind of some of the behavioral health measures. I guess you could say that the tobacco use is kind of a mix of medical and behavioral health. I left it in the behavioral health since it is, you know, smoking behavior, so to speak. But then if we look at medical outcomes, there, again, are a variety that seem to be getting selected by different groups, the same ones being picked time after time. Weight is one. And interestingly, I've listened, I can't really participate in this, but I've listened to some fairly interesting discussions about whether or not body mass index or weight is the better tool to use. And I know the medical director for the primary care piece of our project strongly feels that weight is a better measure than body mass index. Quite honestly, I couldn't tell you why, but so I've listed them both here, okay? BMI tends to be the one that you see more often. Blood pressure is another. Again, if you look at the likelihood of hypertension amongst people who have chronic health conditions, it tends to be fairly high. So looking at blood pressure, this is where you get the interaction between the kind of the behavioral side and the medical side. So as you improve, as you increase exercise levels, what we have seen is weight and BMI and blood pressure all improve, and so does rating of depression. People are less depressed. So you really see the interaction of those things fairly clearly. Hemoglobin A1C, again, all the diabetes, triglycerides, cholesterol. Those are, again, very frequent things that people are measuring. And then I would encourage you to look at the HEDIS measures. Medicaid programs, particularly if Medicaid is in managed care, are frequently evaluated based upon their, you know, their whether or not they're meeting HEDIS measures. And so paying attention to what's on those HEDIS lists is a good idea, because you could be ahead of the curve. There are some new ones for instance, schizophrenia and bipolar that are coming out in 2013 that are really focused on cardiovascular and diabetes monitoring and management for people with those illnesses. So there's more and more of that's occurring. And then the National Quality Forum also provides lists that you might want to take a look at. Process, I guess the process measures that are related to these could be ER visits, inpatient admissions. So those are some other things that you can look at as you improve overall health. You should see a decrease, for instance, in emergency room visits, a decrease in inpatient admissions, again, over time. And then selection of, are some other medical outcomes measures that people think would be valuable here? I think we got the basics.
Yeah, well, this is Andrea from Ada House. One of the things that we collect frequently, mm-hmm. but I don't think would apply to everyone, would be birth outcomes for infants born in the program. But that's kind of specific to what we do. So,
but that's an excellent example of where you look at the population and you say, what are the outcome measures that I need for that particular group?
And
you're absolutely correct. As you select kind of subgroups of your whole patient population, you will end up with different outcome measures. That's great. That's excellent. So, now dental outcomes, I'm going to tell you, I struggled a little bit with, but I did finally find some. The two that popped out were periodontal disease and gingivitis. For those of you who offer dental, what other things would you suggest?
This is Jen again. I can speak on behalf of Scenic Bluffs just because we did have this conversation about how dental outcomes are a little bit more difficult. And one of the things that they look at are these two things, but just simply, did the person have a hygiene appointment annually?
Okay. Now, when you say hygiene appointment, that means getting your teeth cleaned, right?
A cleaning, yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, so we would want to add that to the list. again, that's a process measure, but it obviously has an impact on these other two things. You know, if you don't get your teeth cleaned, the likelihood of some of the dental diseases occurring is going to be much greater.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's great. And again, I think dental's gotten left off the list very, very often. So getting it on the list, I think, is a really good plan if you're offering it. The next kind of outcome measure is financial. And for those of you, of course, familiar with healthcare reform, one of the things that healthcare reform and care integration in general is supposed to be doing is helping with some cost considerations. Now, there are a couple of ways to look at cost, okay, that I think are really important to consider. One is it's a straightforward mathematical calculation of savings, okay? So it cost $200 before, and now it costs $150, okay? The other approach to take, and it's one that may, in fact, be a little bit more prudent for providers, is to say it costs $200 today. At current rates in a year or next year, it would be expected to cost $225. And what I've been able to do is instead of it costing $225, it costs $210. Okay? So what you're doing is you're changing the trajectory of cost. So you're not necessarily bringing down the cost against today's pricing, okay? But what you're doing is you're slowing the cost increase. And I do think it's important to be able to look at it probably in both ways, okay? So cost trajectory, not just pure cost, is a critical factor in looking at this. The other thing is that you want to look at where your costs may go up and where they may go down. So taking the dental exam issue, if somebody just doesn't get dental care, dentistry doesn't cost very much. By adding an annual cleaning or hygiene visit, you've increased dental cost, correct? But it's a good cost increase, okay? It's sort of like medication adherence. People are going to be healthier if they take the medication that's prescribed. So by intervening and providing a lot of health assists and supports to people, you may actually see an increase in prescription cost. But the benefits will be there in other ways. So actually, when you start looking at cost, you almost have to break it out into various pieces. So you expect with integrated care that your primary care cost, your pharmacy costs, and perhaps your behavioral health costs actually go up some. But what you see when you go out far enough in time is savings in emergency room use, in inpatient use. And basically what you're doing is you're preventing higher levels of care, okay? Now, will that hold as people age? It's hard to say. But that's the idea, is what you're doing is it's a combination of decreasing costs in certain areas, but also just holding down the total trajectory, okay? Another way to look at it is per member per month. If you end up in a patient-centered medical home or in an accountable care organization or some other alternative payment structure, you may, in fact, be looking at per member per month cost containment, for instance. So that's another outcome measure. So, and then the final one really is client satisfaction. Is the consumer happy, okay? There are a lot of options in terms of consumer satisfaction. Are people using those now? Is anybody doing consumer satisfaction measures?
We use a lot of them.
Do you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we use one that's been kind of developed from other measures, so it's kind of a put together on our own.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Have you found those to be helpful?
For us, definitely. So, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I find them extremely helpful if you frame the questions in a way to be able to get the information easily from the person.
Yeah.
So we kind of hybrid ours as well, depending on what area we're specifically measuring. I like them. We use them a lot.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. You know, it has to be usable information.
Yeah, and our experience has been, you know, as much as we like the, you know, as much as I, being an evaluator, like the quantitative stuff, the qualitative stuff from the open-ended portions of of the survey end up being extremely useful for the program.
Yeah.
The comments. Yeah, I think
yes,
you're right.
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so having some method of getting both is really important. So, well, and that's great because, I think this is an area where there's going to be more and more focus. And so having you already doing that is really, it's an excellent thing. It positions you really well. So then just kind of the other consideration is if you're not doing kind of outcomes measurement currently, or maybe you're not doing as much of it or as targeted as you'd like, is when do you build it in? Is anybody asking for these data now? Have you had that experience?
This is Meta House. We do. We do collect a variety of outcomes, not many of the specific measures that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions that is we collect those at admit and discharge. One of the questions that I have as we're thinking about this with a collaborative project is where you build it in the process as well, because that's always, you know, part of the challenge of collecting outcomes in general.
Yes, it is.
When and where when you're doing a sort of collaborative project. So it's easy enough when it's just our own agency.
And I think you raise a very good point. You almost have to just really walk through the entire process and just figure out the logic of it. Because it also, if it's collaborative, whose system, if you're using separate systems, whose system is that kind of stuff, that stuff going to reside in?
Yeah.
You know? And the only way, truthfully, that we have found to resolve that question is to walk through the process step by step. And first approach it from the perspective of the consumer, okay? Where are we most likely to get the greatest cooperation and involvement from the consumer? And where is it easiest for the consumer to manage that data collection? And then we start backing into, okay, so now who's going to do it? How are they going to do it? And all those other questions. So you don't have external agencies asking for it much yet, though?
We do. Actually, we report out to a lot of different agencies. We have a few federal grants, and pretty much all our foundation grants ask for outcomes these days. So that's been happening more and more over the years.
Good. So you're getting lots of experience.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, what I would, you know, right now, if you're looking at those data just simply from the perspective of this is a grant reporting requirement, I would encourage you to say, okay, how can I use these data now for other goals?
Yeah, and that's actually, you know, we've always tried to approach it based on what do we want to know as a program, and and then, you know, tailor, when people ask us for stuff, try to tailor what we're giving them to what we collect or what we think is important to collect. That's obviously only so possible, but but yeah, and right now a lot of our measures are not necessarily as much as standardized measures, but anyway, we do have a lot of outside reporting that we try to keep using it to feed what we do so that we improve our process.
That's perfect. You know, where you're not just doing it for reporting reasons, but you're actually making good use of the information for your own purposes. Then it makes it much more worthwhile. It also makes it easier to sell to staff. It's no longer just an add-on. Oh, I got to do that for XYZ. Now it has some inherent value. So, So, okay. Well, that's pretty much what I have. I will tell you that in Health Affairs, and it's the March 2012 issue, Glasgow, same guy that I talked about briefly earlier, has another article, and it's entitled Patient-Reported Measures of Psychosocial Issues and Health Behavior. And what he's saying is it ought to be added to electronic health records. And he's given a list of categories, and you get to his appendix, unfortunately, only if you have a subscription to Health Affairs. So what I'll do is I'll scan the article in and the information that I got from the appendix, because I do have a subscription, and I'll get that to Carol so she can send it out. But he has, what he's saying is, well, that we ought to screen on several different levels everybody coming in. And we ought to look at smoking, physical activity, eating patterns, risky drinking, medication adherence, and I'll get this out to you, so don't try and write it down, depression, quality of life, health literacy, which is something that we all talk about but hadn't thought about how do you screen for that, and then demographics, looking specifically at race, ethnicity, and zip code. And the zip code is really a function of the hot spotting issue, you know, that oftentimes you can identify addresses or zip codes that are high users of emergency health care, for instance. So, and what he's saying is for each of these items, you ask a couple of questions that tell you, should I screen more in depth or not, but that give us collectively a sense of health behaviors across this whole spectrum, since we know that, and the statistic varies, 40% to 60% of healthcare delivered is a function of behavior, not necessarily a diagnosis which would have occurred independent of that behavior. So, as I said, I'll send that out to Carol so she can get it to you. But I think it's an indication of the way in which the field is moving, that we're really looking much more holistically, which, again, is integrated care. So does anybody want to add anything? Any comments? The comments, by the way, you've made along the way have been are excellent, and I think really helped inform this. So, but I think what we should probably do now is just do some quick project updates, if that's okay with people. So who would like to start?